Studio 360.
You're kidding.
Hey, we're on the same block, man. That's where you grew up?
I grew up. My whole life was spent on that street.
That's amazing.
Is that freaky? I got goosebumps
totally
now.
Freak. I know 3A, because they're those Victorian houses.
Yeah.
This is music industry mogul Jimmy Iovine, who I learned as soon as he sat down in our studio, grew up on the very same block in Brooklyn where I've lived for 27 years.
No. The only thing came out of our neighborhood was my cousin, Roseanne Scamandella.
Oh, yeah. Right.
That was my cousin. Right. She lived there.
Her pictures are still like in some of the delis and stuff.
Is right? That right?
Oh, yeah. Roseanne and Scamandella, New Yorkers might remember as a local news anchor in the late 70s and early 80s. Her cousin, Jimmy, turned out to be an even bigger deal. He co-founded Interscope Records and more recently teamed up with Dr. Dre to launch Beats, the headphone company and streaming service, which they sold recently to Apple.
I came out of Brooklyn without an education and without a lot of, you know, feel or culture for that, you know, or understanding of the arts or anything like that. You know, I was in a band, but that was about it, you know?
Jimmy Iovine's music education started in the 1970s when he was 19 and a junior recording engineer. His job, setting up microphones and working a soundboard, wasn't glamorous until suddenly, fortuitously, it was.
I learned from John Lennon, Bruce Springsteen, and John Landau, which was Bruce's manager. And when you, that, it was so condensed, because when you make an album with someone, you're together 12 hours a day, at least 6 days a week, you know. So I did six albums with those people, combined. And I came out of there having a feel for what would go, but yet would still with credibility.
Right.
What could hit.
Right.
But yet still.
Everybody's proud of.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you were, as a, 22-year-old, 23-year-old, working with Patti Smith 40 years ago, did you have a conception of what the audience would respond to her? Because she was a cult figure at best.
Remember, I just came out of Lennon and Springsteen, so I watched the poetry thing be really big. So I had high hopes for Patti.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milton, pot of thieves, wild card of my sleeve.
So I said, why isn't sky the limit on this thing, you know? So at a moment I said, so you know, Patti, we have this great album, but we don't have a single. You know, we don't have a song to make people that don't know you get into the album.
And she didn't say, why are you trying to make me sell out, you suit?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't a suit, but I was.
You were a salesman.
I was, yes, I was a salesman without a suit.
Yeah.
By the way, right before that, I worked in the Leading Mail in Brooklyn, and I was selling suits. So that's where
really?
It all kind of came together. Wow. So I went to her, and she said, I do my own music, man. I don't do one of the people. So I said, look, Bruce has this song that he's not going to use. And I think if you finished it, the lyrics, I think it's going to be so powerful. I can't tell you it's going to be a hit. I can just tell you it's going to be powerful. A woman singing those lyrics, you know, desire is hunger is the fire I breathe, you know, and because the night belongs to lovers, you know, take me now, baby, here as I am, hold me now, try to understand. I mean, a woman singing those lyrics was so powerful.
And hadn't happened, really. I mean,
in the old days, right. You'd have like the Shangri-Las. But in the rock and roll, not at that moment
right.
where
right.
punk was happening, you know?
Well, so you had this tape from the famous Bruce Springsteen, your friend, and you gave it to her and said...
I begged her to listen to it. It took about a month for her to listen to it.
Well, let's listen to it. Here's that tape.
How'd you get that? That's the original demo.
Yeah.
Wow, that's when we cut that record the same day as Fire. He had 70 songs for Darkness on the Edge of Town, and we cut that record. man, working in the hot sun. I remember those lyrics, man.
Was she resistant, Patti Smith, because, oh, Bruce Springsteen is this big, giant star now, and I'm different, and we have a different sensibility, or what was...
Well, they had a Jersey competitiveness as well.
Of course, South Jersey competitiveness.
Right,
yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, they had that going on.
Right.
And, but I just, I learned the, I started to learn the art of persuasion. You know, and I just kept on it, you know. Like my father used to tell me all the time when my mother would drive us all crazy, he says, "No one hammers a nail like your mother." And I think I got it from her.
Oh, well, this turned in, of course, to Patti Smith's big hit.
Take me now, baby, here's I am. Pull me close, try and understand. Desire is hunger, is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed. Come on now, try and understand.
So even though Patti Smith was reluctant to record that, it became more popular than any song she made before or since. I think her only top 20 hit. And right when it came out in 1978, hip-hop was emerging up in the Bronx. When did you start paying attention to that?
My first introduction to rap was Run DMC, but I really still wasn't paying attention. My first moment was when Dre and Suge walked into my office and played me The Chronic, because I didn't understand hip-hop records, because I was a fanatic, meticulous recording engineer. And those records were made really sloppy, the early hip-hop records, on purpose.
Yep.
But I still didn't understand the whole subwoofer thing and the 808 and all that stuff. So when he came in, it was like somebody gave me 3D glasses. So I was like, whatever this guy's doing, I've got to get in business with him.
1, 2. Bring it to the folks. Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre is at the door, ready to make an entrance, so back on up.
I guess you just started Interscope at that point.
Yeah.
And you put out Dr. Dre's album.
The Chronic out, yeah.
Which featured a lot of Snoop Dogg.
Trouble ain't nothing but a G-thang, baby. Too low depth, so get over crazy. Death Row is the label that pays, man. Unfadable, so please don't try to fake this. But back to the lecture at hand.
When I heard the lyrics and I saw what they were doing, they reminded me of Mick and Keith.
You said that a lot at the time. It was very clever.
It just does. It reminded me because they scare you, but they bring you in with their music. I remember going to Jan Winter and saying to him, man, this is Mick and Keith. Put them on the cover.
The editor of Rolling Stone, who at that time, I probably never had a rap artist.
No,
yeah.
No. MTV was the same way. They weren't playing gangster rap during the day, or they only played on MTV raps.
Yeah. And radio stations were not playing single, Nothing But a G-Thang.
Nothing like that.
And so you went out and bought time and just played a minute of the song on
a lot
of stations.
That's what I did. I told my promotion people, I said, look, this has got to get on the radio. So buy a 1-minute spot. Don't do any of that stuff. Just play the goddamn thing. And before you know it, the phones exploded and people had to play it. But that's what led to the record getting in the hands of kids that were going home to like congressmen and all this kind of stuff. And we caught a lot of heat at Interscope.
Well, you did, but you all, first of all, it must have been fun to basically say, screw you to you stations that won't play this. You're playing it because I'm paying you.
Yeah.
But, and of course, you know, Tipper Gore and everybody in Washington, oh my God, listen to the, read these lyrics. It's terrible. But the other thing that happened that you had a big part in doing is making rap music the cool thing for every 16-year-old white boy in American suburbs.
Well, Dre was a phenomenon, and we had him at the same time as Tupac and Snoop. And I knew we had the basis of something extraordinary. So what I did was back it. And I backed it because I knew it would go international as well. Like, I remember my promotion guy saying to me, we're never going to get this record on the radio. I said, they're going to be dancing to this in China. And everybody looked at me like I was nuts. It just caught me like that. Caught me like the wind. It just caught me. It hit me in the chest. And I said, I didn't discover this stuff, but I'll tell you what, we are going to take this international. And we were, who knows what part of it we were, but we were part of that.
I've been saying for a while that hip hop and rap were the last big new invention of American pop culture. Do you agree with that?
Feels that way to me. Feels that way to me. I mean, something's got to give. Right now, it's tough.
Yeah. Lots of people, most people probably, get stuck with a lot of the music tastes they develop between age 15 and 25, and they don't change. Are you just a guy who naturally would have kept discovering music, or you realized, oh, this is my profession. I got to keep my ears open to new.
Yeah. Well, what happened was in the late 80s, I realized that I wasn't a natural at producing anymore, actually in the studio, because I started getting older. And in the 70s and early 80s, it was very natural for me to walk. I knew exactly what to tell the band. I knew exactly what we were doing. As soon as I felt a little bit of that, I said, I'm going to make a label and I'll be able to work with the younger people and be on and learn about the cutting edge of what's happening in music today.
And you did that before you were actually old, when you were barely...
Well, it felt old to me. You know what I mean?
You were older than the
I was 37.
The artists. Yeah.
I was older than the artist.
Another big Interscope band after that was the rap rock group Limp Bizkit. This is... So that's Limp Bizkit's Rolling. I think it's pretty safe to say that the Cognoscenti won't say that that stands the test of time the way Patti Smith and Bruce Springsteen and Dr. Dre do.
You're right. The music, they still go out there and play, I think, but it's not like the stuff you're talking
about. Well, I remember you saying, I was reminded that you said at the time that Fred Durst, the frontman, was like Oscar Wilde and William S. Burroughs. Really?
Did I say that?
According to a Guardian article in 2000, you did. But anyway, in the 2000s, a generation after you'd signed Dr. Dre, he became your partner in Beats, the headphone company and streaming service, which in 2014 you sold to Apple for $3 billion. So now are you an Apple Music employee?
Yeah, I am an Apple employee now.
Do you go to Cupertino and show up?
I go to Cupertino once a week. And we're building a music service. Right now, music needs an elegant way for people to find music, to understand it. And the services are close, but they even need more work to become a really of service rather than just a utility. And that's what people need. People need a way right now to discover artists, to share with their friends, to do it and communicate with artists. Artists need a way to communicate with their audience. And that's what I think streaming services will really catch once that happens.
Yeah. Although, you know, Spotify and Pandora are doing a decent job at what they're doing.
We're at around 30 million people as
well. Yeah. Streaming.
By the way, 30 million people is almost as much as Sirius Radio.
Right.
For example.
Right. Yeah. You know. Yeah. Let's listen to a very popular band, streaming band. These are the Chainsmokers.
Hey, I was doing just fine before I met you. I drink too much and that's an issue, but I'm okay. Hey, you tell your friends it was nice to meet them, but I hope I never see them again.
Now, am I just being a fogey, or are streaming audiences these days more into that kind of nice, untroubling blah, blah?
I can tell you that paid streaming, Spotify paid and Apple paid, the top 20 are 80% hip hop.
So unpaid is what I used to call bubblegum music when I was a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of that going on the mainstream radio, and it's pop is getting there streaming wise. It's no slouch, and this record was top 10 or top 5 streaming wise, but it's primarily the top end is, and it's worldwide, by the
way. That's interesting. Why is that?
Because I think a lot of people listen to hip hop first, some. You know, people that get on things earlier. And I think Drake and Kendrick Lamar really understand how to communicate with their audience. And especially somebody like Drake and Future the Prince's manager. They really understand how to move music through this system, you know? And so their audience follows them there, you know. And
so the people who like the free, the people who like the poppier stuff, it's not unlike when we were young, the difference between Top 40 and like album oriented FM. I mean, those kinds of bifurcations always existed.
Well, you know, it's right now people want to be famous as much as they want to be great.
Unfortunately,
you know, and
or more sometimes.
Well, that's the thing. So you know, it's a tough time for music.
So since you're brilliantly helping Apple navigate the waters of music, why don't you help them make a new breakthrough product?
Because I have no idea how to do that. it takes somebody much more talented than me, like the guys up there.
Jimmy Iovine, this has been a real pleasure. I thank you.
And a great pleasure for me.